This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
In case I forget to announce it at the end of the shiur, I think that this is the last Motzei Shabbos shiur we'll have until after Pesach, because next week I'm taking the week off from Yud Sashen, the weekend off, and the following Shabbos is Shabbos HaGodol already, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? Today too it should be Shabbos HaGodol, so we'll have a big Shabbos HaGodol shiur instead, and the following Shabbos is Pesach, and the following Shabbos is Pesach again. So I think until the first Shabbos after Pesach, until the first Motzei Shabbos after Pesach, there won't be any Motzei Shabbos shiurim, but we don't know when it will be. Okay, we were contemplating about a week before Pesach. Just two things struck me recently. The one was that a psychiatrist who's also a Talmud Chochem was out here recently, as you'll remember, and gave a talk that was entitled In Search of Happiness or something like that. A guide to the achieving happiness, something that led one to believe that if one went to that talk, one would learn how to be happy. And there was a packed out audience at the University Great Hall, which means it's about 2,000 people. Now, it's not even on mysticism you don't get 2,000 people to come to a shiur. So there's something that meant something. That meant that not only that a lot of people are in search of happiness, that's not such a chiddush, but that a lot of people believe that you can find a formula, and that there are people who know the formula, and you can go to a lecture and pay 25 rand or whatever it is and listen for an hour and you'll come out happy, or at least you'll come out knowing how to be happy. The other thing that is of interest, and that's it's a similar thing, is that there is at the moment this enormous concern, interest, involvement in the coming of the Mashiach, without any kind of understanding of what that really involves. And it strikes me that the two phenomena are interlinked. That the desire for the passion for the coming of the Mashiach is not because of the real understanding of knowing what that entails and what it is, and it brings us closer to the Ribono Shel Olam and everything that surrounds the coming of the Mashiach, but that people's desire and almost fanatical dependency on this desire for the Mashiach to come, which must be separated from the obligation we have to believe that at any time the Mashiach will come. But we're not meant to be obsessed with the Mashiach. As I pointed out in a recent talk, there's very little talk in the Torah. There's no talk about Mashiach. In Tanakh, of course, there is. In Nevi'im Achronim, in the Nevi'im Achronim, not in the Nevi'im Rishonim. And even there, the talk about Mashiach is in Masholim. It's in Nevuah, it's prophecies, it's not in philosophies. In the Gemara, there's relatively little talk about Mashiach. In the Shulchan Aruch, there's no talk about Mashiach. When one realizes, after all, this is such a key part of our belief, but it's not talked about much. Just like Olam Habo is not talked about much. We've got to believe that this world is only a corridor to the world to come. Yet there's hardly any mention of the world to come anywhere, because we're not meant to have our minds on that all the time. We're not meant to be obsessed with that. We're meant to be concentrating on living correctly here. And then automatically, as a result of that, we'll find ourselves in Olam Habo. But not to spend our whole lives here planning our Olam Habo. It doesn't work that way. Likewise, we're meant to be aware at all times that the Mashiach can come at any time, and to believe that with absolute perfection in the coming of the Mashiach and in the possibility of his imminence in coming. But nevertheless, we're not meant to be obsessed with that idea all the time. We have to run our lives in a normal sort of fashion. And that's why in Shulchan Aruch in Gemara, one will find so little reference to the Mashiach. And yet today, with all the ignorance that there is, the one thing that people are becoming more and more interested in is Mashiach. And the reason I talked about this recently is I was asked to talk, and I gave them a list of subjects, all sorts of interesting subjects. None of them, they didn't want any of them. I said, no, I've exhausted. I've given you about 25 subjects. You don't want any of them. Tell me what you want. So they said, Mashiach. And who in their right mind is going to come to listen to a lecture on Mashiach? What are they going to come for? No, that's what they want to hear. And they were right. They packed it out with the title of Mashiach. People do want to hear about that. People are interested in that. Why? For the same reason that they go to lectures on In Search of Happiness. There is this belief that this wonderful man will come, he'll be called Mashiach, and he'll wave his magic wand, and we'll all be happy forever after. It's the belief in fairy tales. That's really what it is. And perhaps In secular life, children grow up with fairy tales and they grow out of fairy tales. Maybe in religious life, the children don't grow up with fairy tales, and when they become Bala Tshuva, they're told to forget all their fairy tales, so they've got to look for new fairy tales. And if a psychiatrist comes from America and talks on In Search of Happiness, everybody goes to listen. What's he going to say? And if somebody says Mashiach's about to come, everybody sits up and listens, because this is going to be the solution. This is going to solve our problems. This is going to bring us happiness. It doesn't work that way. The Tanchuma says in the beginning of this week's Medrash, and we'll learn through this whole Tanchuma. Zesha Kosovo Omer Omarti Lahoilulim Al Tahoilu Ulurashoim Al Tarimu Kerim. This, the Sedra starts off with, and was on the eighth day of the Miluim and so on, ultimately leading to the death of Aaron's two sons. This is what it says in Tehillim. I said to those who rejoice, do not rejoice, or those who revel, do not revel, and to the Rashoim, to the wicked people, don't get excited, don't raise your horns. What does this all mean? So the Medrash explains, the Tanchuma explains, Lefi she'ein ha-simcho mamtenes lo'odo. Because simcha does not sit around waiting for people. It moves on. Happiness, joy moves on. Lo kol mi she'someach hayoim someach lomach. One needs to know that not everybody who's happy today is still going to be happy tomorrow. Happiness is something elusive. Joy is something elusive. You've got it 1 minute and it's gone the next minute. And likewise, not everybody who's suffering today will be suffering tomorrow. That's the converse side of it. We need to know both of them. They're both elusive. They come and they go. They come in waves. There are times when they're simcha. There's times when they're not simcha. One has to know that. Difficult thing to chase. And once one has found it, a very difficult thing to keep. It's very one of the exciting things about parenthood is to watch children going through stages and phases, and you relive those stages and phases yourself as you remember them, and otherwise they would be lost to you, you would have forgotten them. And as you see little children doing it, you actually go through it again. Last night on the way home from shul, my son discovered his shadow, and it was very exciting. He tried to catch it walking back from shul. We never walked back from shul so quickly, because he was chasing his shadow. He was determined to try and catch it. It was elusive. He could never catch up with it. It was in front, it was behind, but he could never get it, and he was getting very frustrated. That's how simcha is. It's something we chase, but it's like chasing a shadow. You always see it just in front of you, and you run and you try and get it, and you try and jump and catch it, and then you look behind and it's behind you, and you've got it for a moment and it's gone. That's simcha. Not everybody who's happy today will be happy tomorrow. Not everybody who's upset today is going to be upset tomorrow. These things come and these things go. And then the Medrash gives examples. Starts off. Yotzein choleido, if you want to know to what extent this is so, sharei simchoso shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu lo himtino. Even Hashem simcha didn't wait around for him. Eimosai when? When Hashem created the world, he was thrilled. He had such simcha, he had such joy. Imagine looking at this Bria, seeing every detail of it so perfect, so beautiful, so complete. Shneimar says, Yismach Hashem b'ma'asov. Hashem had joy in his deeds, in his creations. Hashem looked at everything he had created and it was exceedingly good. To teach you that Ribbono Shloim took pride and great joy in his deeds to an extreme. And he gave Odom Harishon one little mitzvah. And he didn't keep it. And so to say, Hashem couldn't retain his joy. And he said, the whole thing was created for man. Now man is going to die. Odom is going to die. He has become transient. There is no permanence in the human condition. What have I done all this for? What's the meaning? What's the purpose? It's like a human being almost going through a crisis of identity. What is my work really for? What is the purpose? What is the value of it if it's about to be destroyed? And so the Ribbono Shel, who had this extreme joy at the moment of his creation, at the time that his creation was complete, wasn't able to hang on to it, so to say. He too found that joy eluded him after a very short period of time, a matter of hours, if that. It was destroyed, it was taken away from him, and he lost that capacity for joy too. If the Ribbono Shel Olam could not retain his joy, a human being, how much more so, can't expect to do so. That's why David HaMelech says, don't take such joy, you rejoices. David HaMelech says, when he sees people rejoicing, he says, what are you rejoicing about? It's elusive, it's here tomorrow, it's today, gone tomorrow, nothing to get so excited about. And then the Medrash gives some historic examples. Avram, kama sameach nisborech bo'ilom nisgadol. Avram, how much simcha did he have? He was blessed in the world. He became great. Horag kama melochim. He went out to war and he killed kings. V'hiknu lakadosh baruch hu shomayim v'oret. He introduced Hashem to heaven and earth. V'nosan lo'i ben b'zik nusa. And then the ultimate, the climax of his life, Yitzchak is born to him in his old age. The bris of Yitzchak, the gidloy, and he brought Yitzchak up and he trained him and he gave his wisdom over to him and he taught him Torah, and Yitzchak grows into this incredible person. The lasoif, and later on in his life, you take your son as an offering. That still was all right; that he could handle. And he went on a 3-day journey. The next day he came back from Haramaria, and what happens now? So now this is really the ultimate of his life. He's reached the level where he was willing to sacrifice Yitzchak, and Yitzchak was saved, and he can take Yitzchak home and start life again. And he comes home to find that his wife is gone. The koval, the soro ishte. He has to bury soro. Uvikesh mokom likvoris. He goes to look for a cemetery. Veloy motza. He couldn't find a suitable place. Imagine the Torah, this old man who's just come back from Haramaria, comes back to and loses his wife, has to now go around looking after his greatness. He's got to go around humbly looking for a place to bury his wife, and he can't find, and he asks, nobody will give him a place. Achikona ba'abu no shekel kesef. Eventually he had to pay 400 shekel of kesef, an enormous price he had to pay in order to find a place for her. Bacharkach kotzol of zikno. And then he became old. The joy of his life was over. He became old. If Avram couldn't hold on to his simcha, you think that the Rishoyim, do you think wicked people can? It's here today, gone tomorrow. Yitzchak lo imtina simchosu. Same with Yitzchak. The Medrash goes on. Next case, Yitzchak. Nimlat min acherev min shei gerar. He escaped from the sword from the people of Gerar. V'odiyah lo him mihuyo. He told them who he was. V'vol him etzlo. They came to him. And Avimelech treated him with great respect after that. They said, we see that Hashem is with you. He achieved enormous stature and enormous status in his society at that time. But he too was unable to retain that simcha throughout his life. Yitzchak became old and his eyes weren't so clear, he couldn't see so clearly. And then the whole story with Yitzchak, with Yaakov and Esav, and so on. My Yitzchak, Shoyo Ilosu Shalakudush Boruchu Kach. Yitzchak, who was Hashem's own sacrifice, couldn't hold on to his simcha. Harishoyim alachas kama v'kama. How much more so with the Rishoyim, with the wicked people? And it goes on. Yaakov, B'choyre Shalakudush Boruchu, Hashem's firstborn. Look how much he had simcha. Roy Sulam, he dreamt about the dream, about the ladder. Umalach Elokim Eilim V'yodim Bo. Imagine such a level to reach, and the angels coming up and down. V'nei Hashem nitzav olav, and Hashem was standing right there. V'yemer ani Hashem, and Hashem communicates with him. He reaches levels of nevuah. Holoch etzel Lovan, boruch mipnei Esav. He escaped from Esav, went to Lovan. V'yavid Yisrael b'isho, v'isho shomar. He worked for a wife, and he worked again for another wife. Built up a wonderful family. With the besoif Heshir, became very wealthy. V'hilid bonim, built up a lovely family. V'chazor u'fogah b'esav, v'nitzol mimenu, goes back to meet Esav, and he's saved from Esav, and reconciled with Esav. V'sholem is nidra, he fulfilled his promise. V'lohim k'tin b'simchoso, but he couldn't retain his simcha either. Elavateitzei Dino bas Leo, there was the terrible affair with Dino, and with Shechem ben Chamor, and then there was Tzoros Yosef, and Imke Le'ever, he loses Yosef, Yosef is sold all those years that he was without him. Uma Yaakov atzadikach, and again, if Yaakov the tzadik, about whom Hashem says, Atol Yisrael Asher Becho Espoir, you are Yisrael, you are Yaakov, in whom I take pride, Hashem takes pride in Yaakov. V'lohim tin b'simcho, so and he couldn't hold on to simcho. Harashoyim alachas kama v'kama, harashoyim how much more so? And it goes on with Yehoshua, same thing. Goes on with Shmuel Hanovi, same thing. With Eliyat Tzadik, it goes on. ואיננו מוצאים איש ואישו שרוסו סמוכס לרויב כאלישב ובסמינודו אישו של אהרי. Yet there's nobody in the Torah that saw such simcha as Elisheva bas Aminodov, the husband of Aaron, the wife of Aaron. Shneema, as it says, Vayikach Aaron is Elisheva bas Aminodov. Aaron married Elisheva bas Aminodov. What simcha sheroso ba'alo kohen godo? Imagine that, marrying somebody and he becomes the kohen godo. Neshamesh b'kuhuna gedoyla, he becomes active in the kuhuna gedoyla. The Novi, and is a prophet. Umoisha achi bailo melech, and her brother-in-law is the king. Look what family she's married into. Her husband is the kohen gadol, and her brother-in-law is the king. And her husband's a Novi, prophet. And her brother-in-law is a Novi as well. Uvoneo sugane kuhuno, and her sons are the deputy kohanim. Bachio nachshoin rosh lechol nesiyah Yisrael, and her own brother, Nachshoin, is the head of all the princes of Israel. Of each tribe had a Nosi, and her brother is the prince of all the princes. Look what a life she's got. The Lohim Tino Bisimchoso, and she couldn't hold on to it either. Elo Nichnasu Shnevoneo Lakrif Korban, Vateitsa Esh Melifne Hashem Vateich Eloisom. Their two sons go in to bring a Korban, and the fire comes out and destroys them. Lekach Neema Aramati Lohilulim Al Tahilu. That's the end of the first part of the Medrash, where the Medrash states that simcha is something transient, simcha is something that even the greatest of people have had for periods of their lives, but not for their entire lives, and that even the Ribbono Shel Olam Kibiyochel had joy for a period of time, but was so to say unable to hold on to that joy. He too became disappointed, and so to say disillusioned, and lost that capacity, lost that joy that he had achieved such a climax of. Joy is something one reaches at a climax, and one isn't able to retain that climax. One has to come down from it at some stage in one's life. Not a very joyful medrash, but a very realistic one. So the first thing that any of these books or lectures on happiness should say is this medrash they should start with. If you're in search of happiness, the first thing that you should be told is you might achieve it temporarily. That's the best you can hope for. But of course, if they said that, nobody would buy their books and nobody would come to their lectures. So they don't say that. They say that there are ways of, and there are means of achieving long-term and permanent happiness. Well, we'll see. There are, in fact. But one needs to know the first thing one has to do is destroy the illusions. And then one can start building on the reality. The illusion of this permanent state of bliss that can be achieved, that has to be blown. We see it isn't like that. That isn't life, for whatever reason. Even the Ribbono Shel Olam himself doesn't achieve that permanent state of bliss. He too had to come down from that climax of joy, from that climax of simcha. Then the Medrash tells a well-known but very strange, peculiar story. Maise be'echod migdoilei bavel, shehoyo meisi benoi berevii shelei, ve'oso se'udo u'mishtel hachachonim. There was a man, one of the great people of Babylon, of Bavel, who was marrying off his son. And he made an enormous su'udah, enormous party for the Chachamim. Amar livnoi, at this party, he said to his son, Olei v'havei lonu chavis yayin pleni min ha'aliyah. Go to the attic and bring for us a particular barrel of wine, the finest wine that I've kept and waited for this day. You go and bring that particular barrel. Olo la'aliyah, he goes up to the attic, v'hikishu nachash, he gets smitten by a snake, ben achavias, between the barrels, umes, and he dies. Himtin oviv im ha'mesuvin, his father is sitting with the chachomim at the table, talking to them, entertaining them, v'shoho v'loibo, and he waits and waits, and the son doesn't come back with the wine. Omar oviv, so his father said, e'le v'ere ma'bini oise, let me go up and see what my son is doing, it's taking too long. Olo Oviv, his father, goes up to the attic, umetzo'oi mushloch ben hachavius, and he finds his son lying among the barrels. Meis is dead. Me'osoi sechosid, what did that fine person do? Himtin be'atzmoi ad she'ochlu ha'urchin v'shosu kol tzorcheihem. He waited until the visitors had finished the party. He served the second course, and he served the third course, and he served the dessert, and he served the coffee, and he served the liqueurs, until they came to the Sheva Brachas, to the ready to make the benching. Kivan Shegomu, when they'd finished, Amalohim, he said to them, Loi Levorech Birchas Chasonim Bosem Albini Boyu Virchol of Birchas Avelim. you haven't been able to come to say Sheva Brochas for my son as you had planned, but at least come and be Menachem Ovel, we can at least do the burial. Lo yilachnis b'ni l'chupa bosim, boyu v'achnisu isu l'kvura. You haven't been able to come to bring my, to celebrate the bringing of my son to his chuppah, at least come and help me take him to his grave. What is the role of that moshel, of that story, of that maaseh in this medrash? Where does it fit in? Sure, we see that there was a simcha which wasn't able to be sustained, but this is different to the theme of the whole medrash up until now. There is a psikta de Rav Kahane in psikta Chof Beis that says the following: Sois osis b'Hashem. There's a posuk in chapter 61 of Yeshayahu at the end of the chapter. Sois osis b'Hashem. I shall rejoice in Hashem. Togel nafshi b'Elokai. My soul will take pleasure in Hashem. Ki il bishani bigde yesha, because He has dressed me in clothes of salvation. Meil tzedoke yotoni, He has put on a coat of righteousness. Like a choson dressed in glory, and like a kalo set out with beautiful adornments. On that first phrase, sois osis b'Hashem, says the psikta de Rav Kahana, v'loy omar b'elukim, it doesn't say sois osis b'elukim, as it says in the next phrase, togel nafshi b'elukai. In using God's name, it uses in the first phrase Hashem, yudke vovke, and in the second phrase it uses Elohim. So the sois osis b'Hashem togel nafshi b'elukai. Ask the psikta, why in the first one doesn't it say also sois osis v'togel nafshi b'elukai? Why is it separated? It should simply say I shall surely rejoice and my soul will take pleasure in God. Why is it sois osis b'Hashem yudke vovke togel nafshi b'elukai? Explains the psikta, lefi shekol hasamochos hoisot soro achareim. We see a similar theme. Because all tzoros are followed, all simchas are followed with tzoros. Funny thing, none of them are not permanent. They start with a simcha, but it doesn't. There's a tzoros involved too. But the psikta gives a reason. Mipnei shehen tuluyos al yedei boso v'dom, because they are dependent on man. Aval siso zu, but this siso that Yeshayahu is referring to, which is the coming of the Mashiach, simcha ve'en acharei hotzor. That is a rejoicing that will have no tzora after it. Lefi shehi bo al yedei Hashem, because this comes from Hashem, not from man. How does that answer the question? If it would have said sois osis b'elukim, what's the difference? Shebechol mokum shu oimer Hashem midas rachamim hu, because wherever it says Hashem yudkei vovkei, that's midas rachamim, that's God, the merciful one. And where it says Elohim, midas hadin, and where it uses the word Elohim, that's midas hadin, God, the just one. What is the psikta saying? What is the difference in this sense between the Ribbono Shel Olam, the merciful, and Ribbono Shel Olam, the Midas Hadin? Midas Hadin is when Hashem responds to us. He gives us what we deserve. That's Midas Hadin. When we're great, when we're fine, when we're wonderful, He gives us good things. When we're bad, He punishes us. That's Midas Hadin. Midas Hadin is not always negative. Reward is also Midas Hadin. When Hashem rewards us for something we have done, that's Midas Hadin. What is Midas HaRachamim? Midas HaRachamim is Hashem is good to us even though we don't deserve it. That's mercy. If you give somebody, if you pay somebody his wages at the end of the month, that's not mercy, that's not Rachamim. That's Din, he's entitled to it. But if you give him a bonus, if you give him something extra, not because he worked hard, you say to him, look, you know, the truth is you didn't work hard. Everybody else worked hard, so I've given them all bonuses. But I don't want you to feel bad that you didn't get one, so I'll give you one too. That's Midas HaRachamim. Giving something that you don't deserve. Therefore, we find that when we use Midas Hadin, when Elohim is used, that is Hashem responding to man. When Hashem Yudkei Vovkei is used, that is Hashem not responding to man. That is Hashem introducing an action, not Hashem in response to the human being. Hashem acting rather than reacting. Elohim is Hashem reacting to us, either positively or negatively, depending on what we've done. Hashem Yudkei Vovkei is Hashem acting, not reacting. And therefore, says the psikta, when we have joy, which is the product of Hashem, of Yudkei Vovkei, it's not caused by us or anything we've done. It's independent, but Ribbono Shel Olam is bringing that simcha. That's something which lasts. But if it's a simcha which is as a result of some human action, it's Hashem responding to us, or it's something we've created ourselves, That's something that doesn't last. That's something that that doesn't go on forever. And the coming of the Mashiach, which is that prophecy that Yeshayahu is talking about in chapter 61, is osis b'Hashem. That's something Hashem is going to bring with His midas harachamim. That's not going to be something we've deserved. Hashem will do this because He wants to do it, and therefore it will be a simcha for all time. And that leads us into some kind of understanding of why we are so desperate about our desire for Mashiach to come. It's not just that it will be happiness, that there will be happiness. It's that there will be happiness ever after. How do all the fairy tales end? Why do children love them so much? And they're nice, especially when they're exciting in the beginning and sad in the beginning. As long as at the end, they all live happily ever after. And then the children go to sleep. I feel I'd like to know that they all lived happily ever after. And we're all little children inside. We like to know that at the end we will all live happily ever after. Those are the stories we like best, and the ones we feel most entertained and comfortable and secure with. And the only story that ends that way of we'll all live happily ever after is the story of Mashiach. That's what this Midrash is saying. There is no other story in life about which you can say at the end of the story, and they all lived or will live happily ever after. There's no such thing. Simcha comes and goes. Tzoros come and go. That's life. Simcha is a tide and an ebb. It's not a constant state of being. Simcha is something you wouldn't feel if it was constant. You only feel joy because it's cyclical, because you have time to move away from it and to come back from it. That's the kind of joy that we have. It's a different kind of simcha altogether. Mr. Drachman asked me on Purim what the difference was between sosoin and simcha. Maybe this is the difference, and that's why he uses the word sois osis b'Hashem. Yeshayahu uses that word of sosoin. But maybe soson is that different kind of simcha, that kind of joy which Hashem brings, which is permanent and everlasting. Whereas simcha is the joy that is toli ba'odom, something that has a human element in it. And if it has a human element in it, it must be cyclical, because we are cyclical. If it has a human element in it, it can't be consistent, because we are not consistent. If it has a human element in it, we don't want it to be consistent, because we wouldn't appreciate it if it was consistent. If it was daytime all the time, we wouldn't appreciate the day. If it was nighttime all the night time, we wouldn't appreciate the night. If it was summer all the time, we wouldn't enjoy the summer. If it was winter all the time, we wouldn't enjoy the winter. Even if it was spring all the time, we wouldn't enjoy spring. Our capacity to enjoy is created by contrast. And therefore, the worst thing that could happen to us would be sustained simcha. Because that would deprive us of simcha altogether. That wouldn't be joy at all. We wouldn't know it was joy. We wouldn't relate to it as joy. There needs to be the cyclical nature to simcha in order for us to understand it, in order for us to relate to it, in order for us to enjoy it. It needs to come and go. It needs to be elusive. It can't be built in. That's the way we are. Until the time of Mashiach, that's a different thing altogether. Then we'll have sosun. Then we'll have a permanent state of simcha. But we need to be able to get there. We need to be able to get to that level and to understand that level. Until the time of Mashiach, leaving that side of it alone, what we see here is that the natural state of the person is not simcha, that it's cyclical, and that simcha is tolui ba'odom, as the Psikta says. The fisha kola simcha is hoyso tzoro acharein. All simcha has tzoro afterwards. Why? Mipnei shehen tuluyus al yedei boso v'odom, because simcha is something dependent on human beings. And that phrase in the Medrash itself is perhaps the most important guide to simcha altogether. Simcha is dependent on an individual. There are no external sources of simcha. There are no external causes of simcha. If there were external causes for simcha, they could be permanent. But since simcha is a state of being, something we have to achieve within ourselves, that's why it isn't permanent. It's tolui ba'odom. And the negative of it is that we can't sustain it forever. But the positive of it is that we can find it. That we can seek simcha, that we can achieve simcha, that it's something that is within us. It's something we are capable of achieving. And if you look at man in modern society, you realize to what extent his desperate search for simcha leads him to search for it in all sorts of external things. Whether it's in his forms of entertainment, whether it's in forms of distraction, whether it's in forms of medication, drugs in the extreme, alcohol, all sorts of things. The people, external objects that people try to use to find happiness. There isn't such a thing. It's tolui ba'odom. That's all it is. And what is the ultimate simcha? That's a different simcha. That's tolui b'Hashem. The same psikta earlier on in Chof Aleph. There's a lovely psikta also that's brought in the Midrashim. The story of Sora, when she became pregnant and had a baby, kivan sheyoldo imenu Sora es Yitzchok, when our mother Sora gave birth to Yitzchok, Hoyu umos ha'ilam ha'imrim. The people of the world, the goyim, were saying, "Chas v'sholom lo yodo Sora is Yitzchak." This is impossible. It can't be that Sora, in her old age, could have given birth to Yitzchak. Elo Hagar shivcha Sora he yodo is. So it must have been Hagar who had Yitzchak, and they made a pretense. They made it as if it was Sora's baby, but it couldn't have been. Me also Hakadosh Baruch Hu yibesh dadei nashesim shel umos ha'ilam. He caused the breasts of the non-Jewish women who had given birth to dry up. They couldn't give any milk. The only one who now was feeding the baby was Yitzchak, was Yitzchak's mother. And the women used to come, and they used to kiss the dust of Sora's feet and beg her, and feed our children. And Avraham Avinu used to say, "Soro enzu shol shel atzneya." This is not a time for tznius. This is not a time for you to hide away and to be tznius. Kadshish moy shel Hakadosh Baruch Hu. This is a time for kiddush Hashem. Ushvi b'shuk, sit in the marketplace. V'haniki b'neihem, and feed their babies. Kedei sheyedu hakol shehitchil Hakadosh Baruch Hu la'asus lonu nisif, so that they should all know that the Ribbono Shel Olam has started doing miracles for us. Says the Psikta. You see from here the Kal Vachomer. If a human being who has Simcha not only has the Simcha for himself but is Mesameach others, Kishiyovu Hakadosh Baruch Hu Lesameach Es Yerushalayim, Alachas Kama Vekama, when Hashem will come to bring Simcha to Yerushalayim, when Mashiach will come, how much more so will that Simcha overflow towards others? If Simcha is so elusive, and yet Simcha is so important, how do we achieve it? Not just the momentary simcha. Sure, we have a simcha in the family, that's a wonderful thing. There's a bar mitzvah, there's a bris, there's a birth, there's a wedding. Wonderful thing, there's a simcha. Sometimes there are other causes for simcha, causes for celebration. Something nice happens, something good happens, one feels simcha. But it's the odd occasion, really. The rest of it is a desperate search for simcha, but if you look at it honestly and in reality, it's the odd occasion that there's a source for simcha. As the Mesivus Yeshoyim says right in the beginning, most of life is jolly hard. It's a battle. It's a moral battle. It's a physical battle. It's a material battle. It's a spiritual battle. We're constantly challenged, working, fighting, struggling. Most of life is not simcha. So it's the odd thing here and there which brings a human being simcha. So human beings need simcha so desperately. They need joy so happily, so intensely, as we see. How do we find more joy than those odd moments? And here we see that simcha is something which one doesn't just have for oneself. Simcha is something which, when one has, can overflow and infect other people too. One doesn't have to rely only on one's own simchas in order to have simcha. It's true, there has to be a cyclical nature to simcha. We have to feel what it's like to have simcha and to watch it wander off into the past, into the distance. We have to feel that feeling to appreciate what simcha is. But we don't have to wait until the next wedding in our own family before we can have simcha again. We can benefit also from the simcha of others. We've spoken once before how the concept of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh L'Zeh, that the Jews are responsible for one another, is not just a concept of responsibility. It's a chiddush that the Ribbono Shel Olam created us all with the capacity to be able to take responsibility for one another. And take responsibility for one another, not in an artificial sense, but in a real sense, because we are all part of one being. Now they give the example always of the person who sits in the ship, and he chips away at the side of his cabin and he's making a hole, and when the captain comes and says, "What are you doing? Are you going to drown us all?" He says, "Leave me alone. I paid for my cabin. I've hired it for the time that I'm here. This is my cabin. I'm making a hole in my cabin. I'm not touching the rest of the ship. It's my own business." And it isn't so, of course. You make a hole in your own cabin, the whole ship comes down. But likewise, that's called Yisrael Arevim Zeh L'Zeh. We're all in the same ship. But one has to see the other side of it too. What happens if the ship is wrecked? What happens if the ship has lost its way? And there's one radio officer sitting on the bridge and listening and listening and trying to make contact. And finally he makes contact. What happens then? Is he the only one who celebrates? Does he start singing and dancing? And does he start with a l'chaim? Does he start drinking? And when other people come along and they say, "Can we join you?" He says, "What do you mean, can you join me? This is my simcha. Who got it? Who found it? Who heard? Who got the SOS across? I, this has nothing to do with you. What are you rejoicing?" He says, "It's the whole ship's simcha." Everybody is in that state of simcha. And so it is, if we're all in the same ship, in the sense that if one of us chip away at our cabins, we're going to sink the whole ship, then when one of us has a simcha, the whole ship has a simcha. And it's a joy for all of us when one of us has it. That's what Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh L'Zeh means, the necessity, the obligation for us to find that capacity to find joy in each other's simchas too. And that's what the Midrash says here. When Sora and Avraham and Yitzhak and Sora had their baby, that was a source of celebration for everybody. But not just because Avraham had a baby, that wasn't the source of celebration. The Ribbono Shel Olam brought out a miraculous involvement of the whole world in that birth, in that they actually came and benefited directly from the birth, that Sora was able to feed their babies too. And that's one of the important things about Simcha. Simcha is not one of those things that by sharing it, it in any way detracts from your own Simcha. Not so at all. It's brought down. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz used to bring it, it's in the Hakdomas of one of the Achronim, that if a human being went up to Olam Habo, and no matter what he saw there, what joy he encountered there, if he wouldn't be able to come back and share his experiences with others, it wouldn't be a source of simcha. So much of our joy, so much of our simcha lies in the ability to be able to share it. In the ability to be able at least to tell somebody about it, if not to actually share it at the time, at least to be able to tell somebody about it. Simcha is not something that can be experienced in a vacuum. Simcha is not something that can be experienced without sharing. Not only does sharing the simcha not detract from the simcha, but sharing the simcha adds the simcha. And by sharing the simcha, what do we mean? That says the Medrash, it's not just the effect of inviting other people to join in, but sameach u'mesameach es hakol. That the one who has that simcha is enabled to infect others with his joy, with his simcha. That's really what it means. One sees that with enthusiasm. What is enthusiasm? That's why enthusiastic people succeed so often. Because it's infectious. When a person's enthusiastic about something, it runs over. It gets other people enthusiastic as well. You can have an idea, and it can be a wonderful idea, and if you sit and you need money for it, for example, and you sit with a potential partner or with a bank manager and you describe your idea to him very factually, very coldly, very analytically, in detail, the chances are you're not going to get much out of it. If you're going to raise money for a yeshiva, for a good cause, whatever it is, and you go and you talk about what a wonderful cause it is, and assuming it is a wonderful cause, you're not going to get very much out of them. Who are the ones that succeed? It doesn't matter whether the cause is good or not. If you make a study of the Meshulachim that are successful, it's not the ones who are collecting for the best causes. It's the ones who are most enthusiastic for their cause. They're the ones who exceed. The ones who, when they're sitting with you, make you excited too about what they're doing. And then they succeed. And so it is in business, and so it is in human relations, and so it is in teaching. Who's the great teacher? Somebody explained to me recently that in what's happening today in South African education today, in South African university education, where it has become a necessity to provide for the underprivileged in education too. So they're moving away, they told me, this is a university professor, they're moving away from the lecture system, more into this work at your own pace kind of thing. The lecture's there to help you along, and each person works at their own pace, and so you can have in the same class people of different educational levels, and providing the class isn't too big, the lecturer can assist everybody at their own level. So he's not lecturing, because if the lecturer's lecturing, there's too big a gap between all the different levels, and he can't get everybody. This way each group is able to work at their own level, and he inputs where they need him, he assists them where they need him. So in other words, all the universities are becoming like UNISA, like the University of South Africa, like a correspondence university almost, but with constant tuition. There's somebody available to ask, to help and so on, but they're doing away with lectures. And this professor said, what a wonderful idea, surprised it took so long to come to it. It's much more effective, you can handle more people, each person on his own level, the progress is much faster, who needs lectures? And I saw a horrific thing starting to happen. And I said to him, what do you think the role of the lecture is? He said, to impart information, but you don't need that anymore. You can use videos, you can use language laboratories, there are all sorts of other methods of imparting information. And I said to him, but there isn't another method of imparting enthusiasm for your subject. So you're going to create a whole lot of automates who know the subject, but they're not going to become enthusiastic about the subject. When you find a professional who's enthusiastic about his subject, you can usually trace it to an outstanding teacher he had. That's the one who really makes him enthusiastic. You find a doctor who really feels a sense of mission in his work. That's because somewhere along the line, he had a lecturer that gave him that sense of mission, that gave him that sense of feeling. And in every subject that it is, the person has been exposed to a mentor, to a guide, to a lecturer, to a teacher who's been able to impart enthusiasm to him. And that's the most important thing. With that enthusiasm, all sorts of things can be acquired. All sorts of things can be achieved if the person has enthusiasm. When there's no enthusiasm there, there's that dull feeling that you've got to go about it, you've got to do it, very difficult to achieve anything. And that's one of the greatest chasodim of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that enthusiasm is infectious. That we can pick up enthusiasm from other people. We can be enthused. But that gives a great responsibility. We don't want to be among the people who are enthused by others, because then we lose control of our own destiny. We'll end up being enthused by what other people are enthused by. But we're able to be the enthusers. We're able to make others enthusiastic about the things we're enthusiastic. If we have a simcha, if we find joy in something, we can spread that, we can pass that over, and that's a true simcha. That's really what it needs to be. And that way a community, a society, a family are not dependent on their own simchas only. They're able to share simchas. When they have a simcha, they can communicate that simcha to others and enthuse others with it. And when others have a simcha, they can enthuse themselves with it. And so it needs to be. And that really is the dynamic that needs to take place within every family and within every society and within every community, within every educational organization, that there's that constant input of simcha. One finds sometimes in a family a child comes back enthusiastic. One of the problems can be the child comes back home from school and there's nobody at home for the child. Terrible. Child comes back enthusiastic from school because of something a teacher said, because of a mark the child got, because of something that happened with a friend, and the first thing the child wants to do is to share that enthusiasm. And the child comes home and there's the maid there. Nobody to share it with. That's serious. People don't talk about that when you've got the whole debate and the discussion about the role of the working mother. But just that moment of being able to allow the child to share its enthusiasm. So what does the child learn to do? Not to share its enthusiasm. And we ruin the communicational abilities after that. The child grows up not knowing how to offload its enthusiasm and enthuse others. Or there is somebody at home, the child comes back later on and wants to talk to the father about something, but he's busy watching the television or reading the newspaper. He doesn't show the ability to be enthused by the child. The child comes overflowing with excitement and wants to tell the parent what's happened. The parent's turned off, busy with the newspaper, thinking about something else, in no way responsive to the child's enthusiasm. We're teaching the children in that way how not to share their enthusiasm. In a family one finds that. One finds that in a school environment, a teacher being able to be enthusiastic, or coming in as if there's a job to be done and we've got to get through the syllabus and that's my job and your job, so let's get on with it. Not depriving the children of the opportunity of enthusiasm. One finds it in businesses, one finds it in a Beis HaMedrash, in a shul, where a whole lot of people learning together. Somebody discovers something, somebody finds something, somebody learns something new. That needs to be shared, that needs to be communicated, the enthusiasm needs to be communicated. When we talk about communication, we're not talking about communicating knowledge. We're not talking about communicating ideas. Nowadays you don't need human beings for that. That can all be done by electronic equipment. That's not the unique role of the human being. What the equipment can't do the way a human being can do is communicate simcha. Communicate the joy, the pleasure, the fun, the excitement in discovery, the excitement in achievement, the excitement and the fun in anything. That's something that we have to communicate to one another. And so we find, as the Psikta says, there are all sorts of simchas, but we need to know that these simchas are tuluyos al yedei boso vadom. The simcha, that the joy that we get, is all dependent on human beings. If we don't strive for it, it will never be there. But even where we do strive for it, we need to know that they don't last forever. They're momentary. We can't live on past simchas. The simchas come and go, and we have to move on to new simchas, whether they're our own or other people's. But we need to know that simchas don't last forever. That's the way it is. And when we talk about looking forward to the coming of the Mashiach and to the time of the Mashiach, we need to know what we mean by that too. That's not some mystical idea, but there we're looking forward to a state where we've reached the kind of level that we can be receptive to Hashem's enthusiasm, to Hashem's excitement, where He'll be inputting us. And when our excitement, our enthusiasm and our simcha comes from Hashem rather from the human condition, then we can know that it's a simcha she'en achareho tzoro. That will be a joy after which there will be no further suffering, after which there will be no further pain and no further anguish. So is osis b'Hashem, as Yeshayahu says, then my soso and my joy in the Ribbono Shel Olam will be permanent and eternal.